This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
To Jikoji, nice to see such a big group here. This week is the beginning of Jikoji's winter practice period, also called an ango. This is a period of usually 90 days, but for us, it'll be 60 days. It's a traditional period of practice that dates from the time of the Buddha. And it just allows us a time for more intensive practice. So our winter practice this year has the theme of continuous practice on the path of inconceivable liberation. That's quite a mouthful. But basically, we're studying a wonderful sutra, the Vimalakirti Sutra, which is a sutra about a lay bodhisattva, not a monastic, not a priest or a monk, but a person just like yourselves. And the continuous practice aspect of our theme is how we become aware of our practice in our daily lives. So I want to talk about continuous practice, I think it's important for us to understand what practice is. I think a number of you attended meditation instruction and learned the posture and the, I don't know if you want to call it technique or not, of Zazen, which is our sitting meditation. And it would be easy to think that that is really what our practice is all about. It is a foundational aspect of our practice. It is integral to our practice, but it's not all our practice consists of. So I want to talk a little bit more about how I understand our practice and the various aspects of the practice. And I'd like to start by giving you like a brief intro to Zen, because perhaps people have ideas about what Zen is or what Zen isn't. And I will give you brief intro to Zen as I understand it, at least six major parts. So the first element I think that is intrinsic and important to Zen practice is the idea of impermanence. The idea that nothing lasts forever. Everything changes. There's really nothing fixed in our lives, though we think it is. I mean, we change, we come and we go, all of us as people, and everything in our lives come and go. There is the feelings you have. The feelings come and go, the thoughts come and go. The world changes. My 69-year-old body is much different than my 20-year-old body. So impermanence, that can be kind of a scary thing, you know, like, there's just nothing for me to grab onto. I'm going to lose you and I'm going to lose that. And, you know, I really want this stuff. And that can be scary, but impermanence can also be liberating, because those feelings we have that are uncomfortable for us, anger and unhappiness, those aren't going to stay the same. They're going to change. They're impermanent. The stories we tell ourselves, you know, like the stories, I'm not a good person, or, you know, I'm so dumb sometimes, or, you know, those stories we tell ourselves, They're not fixed. They're not necessarily fixed. They can change, and they will change. So in a sense, that can be very liberating if you look at impermanence in that way. The idea of impermanence also allows us to be compassionate to ourselves and to others with the understanding of the complexity of life, the complexities of what we're all dealing with, the fact that all of us are in this life in which there's really nothing to hold on to. So that is one of these six elements of Zen. A second one, major one, is suffering. The Buddha taught about suffering and the end of suffering in his first teaching, which is on the Four Noble Truths, which is that there is suffering, there's a reason for suffering, there's an end to suffering, and there's a path to end suffering. Suffering is a heavy, kind of a heavy word, really, because it seems like a lot of us go through life, some people really aren't suffering too much. But if you think of the idea, instead of suffering, dissatisfaction, you know, life isn't the way we want it quite often, and it bugs us. And so Buddha taught that the reason for that is that we cling to things. There's an end to suffering as far as Buddha's teaching goes. I'm not sure Zen teaches an end to suffering. I think Zen teaches a way for us to be with what is unsatisfactory, you know, a way that we can be with what seems to be unbearable, and we can be with the suffering without adding another layer of suffering on top of it. So in other words, suffering. I flunked the test. That's suffering. I feel bad. I mean, I'm really disappointed. But then I add, oh, I'm so stupid. I could have done better. I just really didn't try, and blah, 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 blah. You're adding another layer of suffering on top of the suffering. And Zen, it teaches us to become aware of the causes and conditions of our suffering and not to add another layer to it. So impermanence and suffering, a third aspect of Zen, I think, is mindfulness. And I think maybe you were exposed somewhat to mindfulness in the meditation instruction today. Mindfulness is being present to this moment as it arises in your life. I think many of us live our lives basically doing something else. You know, have you ever driven anywhere, a familiar place, and you get in the car and you're driving out there and you get in the place and you go, oh my God, how did I get here? You know, you're on autopilot the whole way. And that's so familiar to me and to many people in so many other aspects of our lives. You cook dinner and you might get the dinner prepared and not realize the carrots are tasting like that, the onions are like that, the oil, you know. So mindfulness allows us to be present, allows us to accept the gift that is presented to us in every single moment, this amazing, wonderful life that is here for us just to open our arms and receive it. But we don't receive it if we're not aware of it being a gift given to us. So mindfulness allows us to be present to our lives. And, Zazen isn't mindfulness. I think there's an element of mindfulness to Zazen, but there's much more to it. So I don't want to confuse that. But mindfulness is an aspect of of our Zen practice. Another important aspect is attachment. How we get attached to things. Really, most often, attached with a fixed idea of how something should be. Whether the fixed idea is that it should be a sunny day today, or fixed idea that our wife or our husband should be a certain way, or this person in the store should be a certain way. The fixed idea that there should be no forest fires or fires burning in Los Angeles. That idea of these holding on to a fixed views certainly is a way of trying to control things, but you know there's no control involved in that. We cling to our preferences so often. We so often are not okay with stuff that we think is unsatisfactory, whether it be the way the waiter serves us in a restaurant or the way we perform at our job or whatever. We have fixed ideas about that, and that creates a lot of suffering. As you become aware of the causes and conditions of these fixed ideas, they can change. And the beautiful thing is you can allow various people in your life to show up just the way they are, not the way you think they should be, but in the way that they are, whether your idea of them, whether that meets your idea of them or not. And I hope you're seeing that all of these aspects of Zen can result in less suffering or less attachment to our suffering for each of us. So another important aspect of Zen practice is loving kindness. In fact, it's what differentiates Mahayana Buddhism, of which we are a sect, from another a Theravadan or another aspect of Buddhism. I don't know if I said that right. So if I didn't say it right, and Buddhist scholars, please forgive me. But basically in Zen, there is this idea that we are not, that there is no separation. We are not here just for ourselves. We're not here just to awaken. We're not here just to achieve enlightenment. We're here because there's no separation between me and you, or you, or you. We're all one, or we're all easy, better to say we're all not two. I don't think we're all one as exactly says it. So there's an aspect of loving kindness in our practice. There's this idea of a bodhisattva, and some of you have probably heard of a bodhisattva, the idea of a bodhisattva, others haven't. We chanted a sutra today. Jiro called it the Metta Sutra. It can be called the Loving Kindness Sutra. And it is integral to our practice. A bodhisattva is a being who, though has achieved, a bodhisattva is a being who, rather than be released from the circle of births and rebirths, this is the story. It's not literal. I'm not even sure there are births and rebirths. But as the story goes, it is a person who has so much love, so much compassion for all sentient beings, that rather than be released from their own suffering, they choose to stay here with all sentient beings until we all can be released from our suffering. And that is such an important aspect of Zen practice. We have a metta meditation. May all beings be happy. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they feel safe. May they know loving kindness. So important aspect of our practice. I'm kind of rushing through it because I still got to get to the practice part of this, but I thought it would be a good idea to just talk a little bit about Zen. And the last aspect that I want to talk about, I'm kind of threw in called beginner's mind. And I threw it in because I'm not so sure in Asia or Japan or China in Zen practice they talk about beginner's mind, but it became a thing here in America because of a particular teacher and a particular book, I think. And it is a really good idea. The idea of approaching life, your practice, everything like a beginner. Whether Suzuki Roshi said this or someone else, there is the saying that in a beginner's mind, there are many possibilities. In an expert's mind, there are few. And I think all of us in professions probably can recognize that. I have an example. I have a chronic disease. And for the first 10 years I had this disease, I went to many doctors. And most of the time, before I even got the last word out of my mouth, they knew exactly what I had. They prescribed stuff, blah, blah, blah. And, they didn't. They didn't know exactly what I had. And I encountered that expert mind over and over and over again until I found myself in another country with a young doctor who said, meh, maybe it's this. And it was that. So that's just an example of how really having ideas in how things are, because you're really well versed in them, can be an impediment to your practice and to your life in a way. It's important to be curious and to open up to all the possibilities that the world presents us to. Really, a lot of Zen, I think Zen is really about allowing the world to be the world in whatever way she presents herself, allowing the people in my life to be the way they are, in whatever way they present themselves. The awful and tragic and truly horrific things that happen in the world doesn't mean we have to accept them and not do something about them, but we allow them to be the way they are so that we can then make a change and do something about them. So those are six kind of important aspects of Zen. I didn't get into the philosophical things like interdependent co-arising or the 12 links of such a thing. Various things not important at this time. That gives you an idea of what's happening. And all of these, if you noticed, all of these things have relationships to each other. Mindfulness has a relationship to the dissatisfaction in our lives. Impermanence has a relationship to attachment. Things are impermanent. We really want to hold on to the things we think we can. Okay, so continuous practice. I originally was going to talk about how we bring our practice from the Zendo out into the world, but that's not right. That's not what happens. We bring the world into the Zendo. If you've sat Zazen, you know that the world is sitting Zazen with you. I mean, it's very clear. You're not alone. You're not alone in Zazen. So I don't know exactly. I think there's a relationship between sitting in Zazen and the rest of our life, but I also think there's not a big difference between the two. So for me, and this is continuous practice for me, and what's worked and how, why I've practiced the way I have. I think for me, the most important aspect outside of Zazen, which is our foundational practice, is vow or intention. The intention to wake up. The intention to sit, to free all being. So, you know, like, where, how do you get to where you're actually going to make a vow? You know, that kind of a commitment. And by vow, I don't mean a, like a solemn promise. Did anybody see The Princess Bride? Well, so my name is Indigo Montoya. You have killed my father. Prepare to die. That was, he vowed to avenge his father's death. He made a promise to himself. That's really not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a decision, you know, karma. Let's talk about karma really quickly. Karma isn't any kind of metaphysical woo-woo kind of thing. Karma simply is the causes and conditions of our lives, the preferences, the habits, the system of value we all are given that results in a certain way in who we are. You know, it could be that I'm born in Detroit, Michigan, and you're born in Tokyo, or you're born in, you know, some other country. Just the fact, the cultural values of the various countries and places have an influence on us. Our parents do. Our physicality, whether I'm sensitive to my environment or whether I'm very relaxed about it, that's karma. And so vow, and we're given that, you know, that's, you know, that is, I wouldn't call it baggage because it's really an opportunity, and baggage seems like it holds us down, but it is something we carry with us. So vow, and often it takes us into areas of suffering or unhappiness. So vow is a decision not to live by karma. It's a decision to point our ship in a certain direction, to align ourselves with a direction. It's like a compass, right? That is pointing us in the direction of our own Buddha nature. So, you know, vow is a, like, so vow, great, but I don't feel like vow. How do you get to vow? How do you get to where you make a commitment with your life? How do you get there? Well, I'm going to use a bad word to Zen people, some Zen people, not all by any means. I'm going to say you get there by faith. I mean, some people are more comfortable with the word trust. But I'm going to say faith. Faith is the spark, I think, that it starts our practice. And is it faith in Buddha up there on the altar? No. For me, it's faith in the goodness and wholeness of human beings. I believe in the goodness and the wholeness of human beings. I believe that we all have the capacity to wake up. I believe that this practice has worked, and I believe in the reports I receive, either in books or from other people, that the practice works. So our practice is truly experiential. You're never asked to believe in anything or have faith in anything. It's all about your experience and how the truth arises for you. So the faith for me is just that spark that starts this fire, the fire of bodhicitta, which is, you know, like Buddha mind or awakening mind, the idea that I can wake up, that there is a way for me to live a better life, really. Oh, and for me to go deeper into this life. Hatagiri Roshi, which was a teacher in Minnesota mostly, said vow is like taking one step toward the future with all beings. Again, this is not something we do alone. We do it with all beings. And Buddha, and part of this whole faith deal is that Buddha said, though I haven't found exactly where and what sutra he supposedly said this, when Buddha woke up after many years of trying to wake up, trying many different things, he said, I'm just sitting here until I wake up. I'm not going anywhere. And when he woke up, he became enlightened. And when he became enlightened, I'm going to read this. When the morning star, he reported what happened. When the morning star appeared, he woke up. He became aware. He said, when the morning star appeared, I and the sentient beings on earth simultaneously attained enlightenment. It can be no other way. If there's no separation, Buddha doesn't wake up without us all waking up. So in a certain sense, we're all awake. We're all awake right now. In a certain sense, you don't have to do anything. In a certain sense, you're perfect just the way you are. Suzuki Roshi said, you're perfect just the way you are, but try a little harder. So there's an element of what we call Buddha nature that we all possess. And that nature supports the vow. So see if there's anything else I want to say about vow. Vow is really, again, allowing. Vow is welcoming your life as it appears, moment after moment. So I've taken this vow, you know, I'm going in this direction. I have lots of causes and conditions that make me the way I am. I'm going to look at those, but I'm going to be sailing in this direction. That's vow. That's been so important to my practice. Devotion, also an important aspect. By the way, vow, we're constantly vowing in Zen. We will vow later. We already vowed. We're going to vow. We're always vowing. Devotion, well, we're always vowing. We're the rope chant we chanted this morning is a vow. After the Dharma talk, we're going to chant the Bodhisattva vows. We're going to vow to save all beings. We're going to make an impossible vow. We're gonna make a vow that says, delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. We're going to make a vow that says, sentient beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Well, come on. How are you going to do that? If delusions are inexhaustible, how do I end them? If human beings are numberless, how do I free them all? It's an endless vow. The vow never ends. You never get to the point where you meet the guy that killed your father and you can wrap things up and go on with your life. It doesn't happen that way. It's an impossible vow, but still we do it. Still, we make that vow. It's impossible. It's ridiculous in a way. I mean, there are no smart people in Zen, because a smart person would not vow that I'm going to free numberless beings. It doesn't make any sense, but still, we vow. We vow to free all beings. So part of vow is devotion. Devotion, I don't know if this is actually true, but I read somewhere it derives from of vow. And when we're making prostrations, when we're offering incense, we're not offering it to a god, or we're not I'm not offering it to Buddha. Buddha might as well be a Buddha up there might as well be a mirror, because I'm offering it to myself and everyone else, my Buddha nature, the fact that I have the capacity to awaken, that beautiful gift that I've been given and we've all been given. I have devotion for that. I make a vow for that, and I prostrate myself and I raise my all Buddhas, all of you on my hands. So devotion is also part of our practice. I mean, we have altars. Okay, so vow. And then there's a couple of other things I think that are really important to practice outside of Zazen. One of them is the precepts. It's something that we all of us who have been ordained either as monks or as lay people, because there are lay people who are ordained. We take well, there's 16 of them, but there are 10 prohibitory, I could call them precepts. And they're pretty simple things like not, let me see, I wrote them down here. No taking life, no killing, no taking what's not given, no stealing, no lying, no speaking falsely, stuff like that, right? So these precepts really call our attention to things that are creating suffering for ourselves and others. And it's not really like the commandments, though it sounds like the commandments. There is a deeper meaning to the precepts. The precepts in Zazen are symbiotic. You know, there I'll give you an example. I wrote one example of something so you could understand perhaps a deeper nature to the precepts. So the precept, no killing, no taking life, right? So that could mean don't eat meat. It could mean don't be in the army, or it could mean all kinds of things. But the reality is we're always killing life. All of us kill life every day. I do, and we all do. But if you look at the precept from a deeper nature, a nature from not so much a relative place, from an absolute place, so I could say it like this. The same precept, no killing. Self nature is wondrous and imperceptible. Within the everlasting Dharma, which means within this existence, not arousing the view or the idea of extinction is called the precept of not killing. The view of extinction is essentially a view of deep separation. It sees some part of the reality of life as so completely separate that it can be eliminated without injury. So what's that basically is saying is that, hey, there's no separation. The deeper meaning of no killing is that it's not possible because we're all connected. But it is possible to kill. So that's Zen. It is possible to kill. It's also not possible to kill. So we have those precepts, and I won't go through all of them, but there are 10 of them, of the prohibitory ones, and they're typical: no lying, no slandering, no gossiping, the usual. Don't get angry. Okay, so precepts, and then finally, the paramitas, and also called the perfections. And those basically are in our practice, there's six. And they're basically virtues of a bodhisattva. I talked about a bodhisattva. Bodhisattva requires a skill set, you know, like you guys have jobs, there's a skill set to various jobs, there's a skill set to being a bodhisattva. And that consists of generosity, morality, and by morality, basically, they mean the precepts. Patience, effort or energy, and wisdom. I don't know, is that six? I don't have them written down here, but generosity, morality, energy or effort, patience, wisdom, and probably mindfulness, I think is the six. And those are like something that is called in Japanese, I don't know if it's Japanese, but upaya, skillful means, or the skillful means that a bodhisattva uses to free all beings. So that is the end of the intro to Zen. Now you know everything there is to know. We could all go out there and be bodhisattvas. It's a simple thing. Just let the world be the world. So I just wanted to say one last thing about continuous practice. Oh, by the way, part two, next Sunday, continuous practice. Today we talked about practice. Next Sunday we're going to talk about what continuous practice means. So come on back. So that's the end of today's talk, and we have a little time for questions. If anyone has any questions, I'm happy to see if I can answer them.
Oh, I think Jackie online.
Oh, yes.
You need to unmute.
There we
There
go.
you go.
Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
Thank you for your wonderful talk. So I have a question about what you do when you fail. I failed to appear actually at Jikoji today, which was my intention. And I feel bad, you know. I go, oh, I could have, I would have, I should have. Why did I not, you know? And so I'm kind of stuck with regrets and things. And what is the proper, or what is a more productive way to be when you have failures or problems, or you wish things had gone differently, or that kind of thing? It's just
Okay, so Jackie asked, what do you do when you fail? When you like she wanted to be here today and she wasn't able to, so she considers herself a fit. Maybe she didn't say she considers herself a failure, but she failed and she feels bad about failing. So I talked about allowing the world to be the way the world is. It's also important to allow yourself to be the way yourself is. That failure or those things we don't like about ourselves, they're so precious. They're such precious things. They're like little bodhisattvas. They're bodhisattvas that have come to wake us up. Failure has appeared. Don't push it away. Don't say, oh, bad failure. I'm going to push it away. It's not right. I think it'd be more productive to embrace your failure, be present to it. When I say embrace your failure, it's not like I mean go out there and fail, but it's like, you know, I hug you, I love you. You know, you are, and be present to whatever comes up. I'm a big I don't know about fan, but I think being present to the feelings and just with as much as you can without a fixed idea of the feeling is a beautiful way to be. And so be present to failure without a fixed idea, or the idea of failure without a fixed idea of how it should have been. And understand that that failure has come to teach you something. And it's precious.
Thank you.
Yes.
Is there a time where you need to be vigilant?
In what sense?
In a sense of impending danger of some kind, could be small danger or big danger.
Can you make one repeat for them, please?
Okay. So he asked, is there a time when it's important or appropriate to be vigilant? When I think of vigilant, I think of sort of a hyper alertness. And I also think Is there an element of expecting danger or something happening? Is that part of being vigilant or not?
I'm sorry, is that a
Is
question? Or...
it's a question to you. It like in other words, is vigilance being vigilant include the expectation of something happening?
We'll say in the state that our world is right now, and constantly things are happening. When do you take action in the sense of, I don't know, maybe your family or friends?
So I think it's important to be mindful and to be open. If vigilance includes a fixed idea of something happening in a certain way, then I don't know if that if it's if but if vigilance is being mindful of a situation and being prepared to respond to a situation, then I think we always should be vigilant in that sense.
Because it kind of, I guess, contradicts the idea of attachment a little bit.
Well, that's why I asked if there was an implication of something occurring and being attached to the idea that something is going to happen, and then responding to that idea rather than to the reality. So you have an idea, world is a dangerous place. You respond by being hypervigilant. You're responding to an idea, not to a reality at that point. So I would say, yes, it is a contradiction. But if you're in the wrong part of town, or if you're on a road with, where there could be forest fires or whatever, vigilance is, seems to be a reasonable thing to be. Yes.
Well, you mentioned that this is purely experiential practice and it works. There are many other practices that claim to work. So what for you, wise practices like better or more efficient to get what we are trying to get?
So the gentleman asked that I said that the practice was experiential and that I found it worked, which I'm regretting saying that right now. But I don't, I'm not saying it's better than any other practice. I didn't say that, and I wouldn't say that. I would say for me, it's experiential in the sense that nobody is asking me to believe in anything or to go against my own best idea of something or someone. No one's asking me that. What they're doing is they're what I'm doing is nobody's asking me anything, honestly, but what I do is sit and try to, like I say, allow whatever comes up in this moment to come up and to be with that. So what works for me is that aspect of understanding and going deeply into the causes and conditions of my own suffering. So through, for example, understanding impermanence, and in any particular situation, understanding the impermanence of that particular situation. My suffering or my working, if reducing my own personal suffering is working. And this is one element of Zen. It isn't, it is just a sliver, and it's really to kind of opening this Dharma gate for people who are interested in going through. It's all I'm doing. There's much more. And I hope I don't give people the wrong idea, but for me, my life is, I have less suffering. I'm attached. That's not true. I find my relationship to suffering has changed through practice. I guess that's the best. My relationship to my suffering has changed, allowing me more equanimity in my life, allowing me more empathy, allowing me to be more compassionate to other people and more open to other people. And I think there are many practices that would have the same kind of results. So. Hi.
I'm always deeply curious about and struggle with, I guess, perpetuate my own suffering around this. The being who I am and allowing myself to be while also allowing the world to be, and the fact that there are going to be contradictions and discrepancies, and the ability to like be true to that vow or that compass or that North Star or whatever, while also like not being able to change anything, and just sort of like, how does one stay the course when one is influenced, obviously, by everything else around us? And I understand that sitting and the meditating and the mindfulness and these sort of principles can be helpful. And it's like, we'll get there when we get there, and we may never arrive. But that's sort of the, when there is a conflict between sort of values or vows or compass or path, and I think this often is with what we're trying to like move through. I don't even know if it's a question, but like, how, like, what is it that can sort of propel us to keep forward while managing, right, like all the things that are actually holding us back? And you know, a lot of the times it's ourselves. So I'm not sure if any of this made any sense or if there's really a question, but and there's probably not a simple answer, but just, yeah, like, could you say more, a little bit more about that? And maybe that does link to the daily practice, which we'll hear more about next time, but like, day to day, like, how, what is the mechanism that helps us?
I'm not going to try to repeat that question to you. So I'm just going to give you my response. It is a really important question. I completely understood it and have felt it might the same. I think, you know, like when you're doing Zazen, there is this, I don't know what it's called, but there's this thing that happens or that we do, that we, thoughts come up and thoughts go. We let thoughts go, but sometimes we don't. Sometimes we hold, grab it, and you know, it takes us this way. We become aware of it, and we come back to our breath. So we do that over and over and over for thousands of times, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of times in a lifetime of meditating. Do you get distracted, taken away, and come back? So I feel like you have a choice. It's just making a choice over and over and over again. You know, when I noticed I got distracted or I got carried away with this thing, at that moment, I had a choice. I had a choice to go or I had a choice to come back to my breath. So I think in life, for me, the idea that I literally have a choice and I can make a choice for myself in any moment is helpful, and it might just have to happen over and over and over and over again, just like Zazen. I heard the dinner bell, the lunch bell, so I think we'll tie it up and we'll go eat. We're going to say one, we're going to say that beautiful Bodhisattva vow that's on page 2. We begin with we begin a little differently, and we go into that wonderful vow. I hope people can be present to the beauty and the power.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.